produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Gervier, and Wayne Hall. This is Yes Music Podcast, episode 448. What Did They Do Next? Part 16b, Rick Wakeman again.
Hi, this is Alan White from Yes, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 448 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulryan, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along a little bit later on. You can always get involved with the podcast yourself via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. Mark and I have had an interesting week, firstly trying to get hold of and then listening to the collaboration album Wakeman with Wakeman by Rick and Adam. A lot more on that in a few minutes' time. Around the social webs this week, and starting with the YMP Facebook page, John D spotted a remarkable promo for what was originally called the 80102 Yes album. I remember hearing that the name changed during production, but I had not heard this actual radio promo using the former title. Interesting stuff. I took delivery of my next Tormato copy. This one is a real beauty, a 7-inch SACD package with a lovely miniaturised sleeve, obi strip and Japanese booklet. The Japanese really know how to produce amazing products. In the community posts, Jeffrey Mason added another new interview with John Anderson, where he admits he misspoke, in inverted commas, in a previous interview about Yes Official. He says, "So, Steve and his band, I don't mind. They go out and sing songs that I wrote and me and Steve wrote, which is fantastic, and keep the flag flying, if you like." Great sentiment, in my opinion. John then goes on to say, "They're very good at doing Yes classics, but I've been waiting for some new Yes classics, you know. It's very hard without me." Make of that what you will. Jeffrey also adds a short documentary on the creation of John's 1000 Hands album and a GuitarWorld.com article on Trevor Rabin's guitar sound for 90125. Dave Watkinson has found another music paper clipping. This time, Yes require an experienced road manager. So if you have a time machine, you can go back and apply for that if you like. Over on Twitter, Joost Maglev spotted a new Yes Music podcast. Well, it's actually the Yes Theory podcast, but check it out if you think you might be interested. Don't expect it to be quite like this, though. On UK TV, Dave Watkinson spotted a show called That's 70s, which featured, I think, wondrous stories, and Simon Knights tweeted his copy of Roger Dean's book Views, still a classic. Gwen Sciorra, I hope that's how you pronounce your name, Gwen, has a signed copy of Steve Howe's Beginnings, and I should have some news on the new Yes live album soon, so watch this space. Finally, if you missed a comment from Doug Curran on the show notes from last week, he says, and this is a spoiler alert, so skip forward 15 seconds if you don't want to know what's coming up for Yes. The plan is for Yes to record a show or shows next year for a live album, with all of Relayer, and hopefully film it for DVD/Blu-ray. So thanks very much indeed to everyone who's been in touch this week in any way, including the commenters on last week's show notes. Simon Barrow, who seems to have a cold, Doug Curran, who answered a question Mark and I repeat later on in the episode about Wakeman and Wakeman Live, H.B. Pedersen, who had some very interesting comments on the album of the week, and Ian N.B., who's unimpressed with the track list of the new Yes live album.
Olá, sou o Miguel Falcão, de Coimbra, Portugal. Estão a ouvir o Yes Music Podcast.
Before my thoughts, and to answer a question posed later by Mark and me, here's Doug Curran again. He says, "I saw the Wakeman & Wakeman gig in Cleveland in 93. I hadn't seen Rick solo since 75 with King Arthur. Wonderful show with Adam, Tony Fernandez on drums, and I think Alan Thompson on bass. A wonderful surprise to hear all of Journey live. Could have done without Painted Black myself. Met Rick, Adam and Tony backstage, thanks to Rick, who I've known since 75. Rick was under the weather, so left me early with Adam and Tony, whom I hadn't met before. They were both very, very friendly. Tony and I talked about his work with Straubs, as well as his work with Rick, starting with No Earthly Connection." And here's H.B. Pedersen on the album. He says, I've owned the Wakeman with Wakeman CD since it came out in 1993. It's not that great, but it has some nice moments. The trouble with it is that it's chock full of cheap synth presets, a recurring problem with Rick's keyboard set up since the early 80s. However, I adore After the Atom. It's a wonderful, cheesy 80s track, like something you would expect to hear on Miami Vice in 1987. I love it. It's a mix of ABBA, Jan Hammer, Tangerine Dream, and instrumental Pet Shop Boys. I don't have this album anymore, he says, as I threw away 2,500 CDs during a recent move. I'm only collecting vinyl, so I can't really comment much more on it, other than I've almost never played it anyway. So, thanks to both of those commenters from last week's episode. I have received my CD of Wakeman with Wakeman, and it's somewhat minimal in its production values. Even for 1993, the design is perfunctory, despite an interesting photo of the two Wakemen on the back and a decent logo based on the initials WWW. The release seems to have come from Rio Digital and Ambient. Rio Digital released a number of Wakeman albums in the 1990s, and if you're from the UK, you'll recognise some of the other artists that they have handled, including Roy Chubby Brown and Keith Chegwin, presumably the latter playing pop. However, the label also produced some of the works of Procol Harum, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, and Denny Lane, apparently. Anyway, the packaging of this album is a family affair, as the cloud photo on the front cover is by Adam Wakeman himself, and the one mentioned above on the back is by Nina Wakeman. The logo is by Rick Wakeman, and the sleeve notes are the briefest I can remember on any CD, but what really matters is the music, after all. So there are 11 pieces of music here, and I have to say I'm slightly nervous of listening to this self-proclaimed ambient album. This kind of music has a dubious reputation in the UK, particularly amongst privileged white middle-class musos like me. When I dip into the later music of Mike Oldfield, for example, I'm often put off by the character he seems to have moved to, away from the experimental days of Tubular Bells, that is the first one, Omadorn, and even Crises and QE2, and more towards the so-called New Age, vaguely impressionistic and slightly superficial area. But I digress, back to Wakeman with Wakeman. The first piece is called Lure of the Wild, which was apparently an alternative title for the album, although I haven't seen any evidence of that in my brief searches. I don't know what I was expecting, but synth sounds like a huge sci-fi jet engine starting up. Wasn't quite it. It's a very tantalising sound as it moves slowly through some held chords and sweeping effects. Suddenly there's a cowbell. No, really. And a synth pop beat below some typical Wakeman Hammond organ patterns. It's deeply rooted in the 1980s, but you can't deny the quality of the synth soloing over the top of the mix. It makes me smile to hear this earlier version of some of the approach on the latest offering, The Red Planet. It sounds a lot more synthetic, but it seems to exist in the same overall soundscape, or at least universe. It's actually rather enjoyable, as it trips along with contrasting sections of low, bassy and orchestral stab fun. Then that soloing is back, and as always, this couldn't be anyone else apart from the Fleet of Finger Wakeman. It's difficult to tell whether it's Wakeman Senior or Junior, but whatever the case, I like the music. And this piece is definitely not too ambient for my tastes. I prefer it with all real instruments, like on The Red Planet, but this is a good start to the album. Next up is the Beachcomber. An ostinato keyboard riff is set up and a deep bass line added before a substantial sounding synth solo is added. The curlicuing figures are then repeated by a totally different piano melody with a basic and fairly standard bass line and drum accompaniment with vamping 1980s sounding synth chords. Not my cup of tea really, but effective enough in this shorter 4-minute piece. Of course, Rick shows off his wonderful piano abilities and the rhythm then returns. A decent piece, not very memorable, and doesn't really go anywhere. Megalomania is next. The title reminds me of Rick's involvement with the certifiably odd film director Ken Russell in the 1975 film Listomania, where he appeared painted gold as Thor. However, Megalomania was composed and is played by son Adam, but still I wonder if this piece is as strange as that film. Well, it's only 3 minutes and 5 seconds long and opens like soundtrack music, but not to a Ken Russell film, more like the piano accompaniment to a late 80s rom-com. Suddenly, strident keyboard chords appear, as well as electronic drums, and we are now in TV theme territory. Maybe another Fame spin-off, or a cop buddy series. As usual, there are moments of Wakeman ingenuity and brilliant soloing, particularly towards the end, which almost save the whole thing. But overall, this piece would probably have done well as an actual TV theme. Raga and Rhyme begins, and we are catapulted into a synthetic version of Steve Howe's Koto-based songs. The sound is a kind of mix of pseudo-Chinese Koto and sitar, and it becomes a kind of mesmerising, hypnotic backdrop. There are more keyboard solos added on top. It's a fake sound with a hint of disrespect to the national music of the originating countries. I'm sure that wasn't the intention, but this 3-minute piece is somewhat disconcerting to me. The next title has another joke in it, Sync, as in Sync My iPod, or Swim. Chords, while a kind of enhanced harpsichord, plays over the top in a seemingly improvised manner, accompanied by counter-melodic synth. Then a jaunty poppy groove hits us with overtones of Jan Hammer again. More fine synth soloing makes this piece rather more interesting than some of the others so far, but it's still fairly basic, and it makes me wonder what The Red Planet would have sounded like if it had been all computer programmed like this, and not employing the sublime talents of real musicians playing real instruments. I do like this piece. It has momentum and fun, but how much better would it be with an actual band? Quite a bit, I think. The music ebbs out to a close amid various washes of keyboard colour. Jigger Jig, I suppose, is more what I was expecting. Huge piano fireworks in something like the manner of the piano sections of Catherine of Aragon, but with a touch of the Wild Western Saloon, in a way. I think I can indeed hear Adam here, as it says on the sleeve notes. It's a lot of fun, and some of the most enjoyable playing so far, despite featuring only piano, or pianos. It's just under 4 minutes of sparkling piano work, which I could listen to again and again. The genre of the music is indefinable, but I don't care, it's great. The end even sounds a bit like the close of Cans and Brahms from Fragile. Caesarea is the longest piece on the album at 9 minutes and 17 seconds. It opens with arpeggiated keyboard patterns and a slow-moving low solo. The wordless chorus from King Arthur are back, but this time synthesised. Little touches of pitch bending remind us that this is Rick Wakeman, and then a lovely Moog solo confirms it. It's all fairly middle of the road, however, but it works fine. It's a bit like the soundtrack to the triumphant entry of a conquering hero into a city in a late 80s film. But, hold on, we're now thrown straight into an 80s dance feel, complete with groovy bassline and drums. The main feature is, of course, Rick's remarkable soloing, but the rest is a bit off-putting. Some neat key changes lead to a solo which could easily be supplanted straight into The Red Planet without any alteration. Maybe all the albums which led up to the magnificent Red Planet were honing the art of Wakeman. Surely not, but this is unmistakably him in tone, in heroic soloing, and in arrangement. It's the most progressive sounding piece on the album, but with a lot of 80s references and highly incongruous aspects, like a wonderful Hammond organ solo thrown into the melting pot. Enjoyable, but an odd mix. After the Atom starts in a very dramatic way, but the use of orchestral stabs a la Owner of a Lonely Heart is excessive. Despite this, it's a bright and exciting sound with lots of great piano. A sudden and wrenching change brings a slow-paced but spiky attack synth against a relaxed drum beat. It's a strange contrast, but if you can cope with the keyboard tones, it's an interesting texture. Moog soloing, I think, but I'm no expert, takes over, which is, of course, brilliant, but this piece is 4 minutes 56 seconds long, and we're practically at the end already. As I was expecting, the opening material reappears, and the whole piece feels as if it was thrown together very quickly. Rick is perfectly able to do this, often with remarkable results, of course, but maybe some more development time on this piece would have reaped rewards. The uncomfortably named Suicide Shuffle is one of those Wakeman pieces you either love or absolutely can't stand. Listen out for Adam on organ on this one, if you can keep the track playing despite the oral assault and battery. It's the cartoon caper version of Wakeman, and not even the odd time signature can save it. British Music Hall meets Saturday Morning Kids TV, and not in a good way for me. The organ playing is actually good, but I really don't need to hear this piece again. The musical equivalent of a really bad knock-knock joke. Past and present is Adam on his own, I understand, composing and performing. There's only 3 minutes and 22 seconds of it, and it sounds a little like solo piano silent movie accompaniment. The fingerwork is fast-moving, with a lot of chordal sequences and single bass notes to pin it all down. Key shifts are fun, but then somewhat unsurprisingly, a band section appears, with some great Hammond organ and Moog-sounding soloing, in a slightly different style to his father, but just as nimble and exciting. Solo piano reappears with a repeat of the opening material, perhaps predictably, but this short piece highlights the skill and musical prowess of Wakeman Jr., and it's one of the more enjoyable tracks on the album so far. Finally, we reach the cover version, and it's the last piece on the album, the Rolling Stones' Painted Black. There's an explorative mood at the beginning with a keyboard improvisation on the theme of the original melody, with overtones of the sitar-like approach taken by the Stones themselves. Accompanying this is a brooding bed of effects. It's a promising start, but then the Giorgio Moroder drums and synth bass come in. Yes, you heard me correctly. Wow. As mentioned on the sleeve notes, Adam plays an initial major solo, which is fantastic, despite the accompaniment, which travels interestingly around the vocal line. I think Rick then takes over with an archetypal speedy Moog solo mixed in with some gorgeous Hammond. It's difficult, but if I concentrate, I can appreciate the brilliant synth and Hammond soloing, and the accompaniment fades a little into the background. I wonder if nowadays Rick and Adam would just have sent the files to musicians, likely Pomeroy and the other guys in the English rock ensemble, to replace the synthetic band parts. And if so, I think this final piece and several of the others could have been very successful. As it is, this collection is another bizarre one from Rick. Some of it seems about 10 years out of time, with early 80s overtones rather than early 90s. Other pieces feel like they were hastily put together and could have been developed further to become more satisfying. And the less said about Suicide Shuffle, the better. So my overall recipe for making this album significantly better would be: get real musicians to replace all the programmed accompaniments, reduce the number of pieces, develop a few of the remaining ones into rounded compositions, and never return to the Suicide Shuffle, or anything like it.
Greetings, friends, and welcome to the next installment of our What Did They Do Next series. And as we mentioned the week prior, we are going to be taking a look at the 1993 release Wakeman with Wakeman. Now, as a quick preface to my thoughts of this record, I'd just like to make a note of how much of a challenge it actually was to get this record to listen to. When we decided to do this record, Kevin and I immediately went online and purchased copies of it. As I understand, he got his rather quickly, and I am still waiting for mine a week later. But thanks to the wonders of the internet, I was able to get a copy from Kevin so that I could at least listen to it and give my thoughts proper to it. Otherwise, I'd still be waiting for my CD. Anyways, enough of that. Let's get on to the CD. So 1993 is when this album came out. And when I got this album and put it on for the first time, I must say I was whisked away to years past. But it wasn't 1993. It was more like 1983. Yes, yes, Rick Wakeman once again shows that he has a little bit of trouble keeping up with the times when it comes to this sort of music, at least in my opinion. Again, the performances on this are very good. I mean, when has Rick ever been a poor performer? Never. His only faults I find with his records, and I own numerous, is that once he gets to a period like this in the 90s, where he's pumping out albums like 4 or 5 a year, he doesn't seem to put as much attention to detail in it as he did on records like Six Wives, Journey, King Arthur. These ones, it just almost seems very slapdash to me. It's almost like, okay, here, Rick, here's $4,000. Can you make a CD for us? Yeah, sure. Give me 3 or 4 days and I'll get something for you done. That's exactly how this kind of felt to me. Let's talk about a few of the songs. For example, the opening track, The Lure of the Wild. It's a 7-minute song, and it's pretty much your cookie cutter sort of instrumental track that he's always sort of done. But the one thing I noticed about this song, and at least for the first couple of songs, when he uses the Moog in this, or it may not even be a Moog, maybe it's one of his Korg keyboards, he has this very odd lead sound. It has this really weird like P tone to it, like pa-pa-pa-pa-pa-pa-pa-pa-pa, like when he does this lead work, it has this very odd tone to it. I don't know if I find it annoying or if it's just odd. It's a very strange sound, one that I'm not really used to from his soloing, as far as if he was attempting to do a sort of Moog lead sound in that sense. Now, the next song on the record is called The Beachcomber, and once again, it starts off with an interesting sort of keyboard passage line that he does on the keyboard, which is interesting. I find that quite melodic and very well played. But then again, we're quickly given that very strange lead sound again, in there. And another thing I'm starting to notice already by song too, is I'm not liking this whole programmed percussion bit. I mean, back then, in 1993, the sort of programming drums that you would get back then were really noticeably programmed. I mean, it's not like how it is today. I mean, now you can do drums on computers that you'd be hard-pressed to believe are not real. But back then, man, was it ever noticeable that it was not a real drummer, and it's starting to stick out like a sore thumb on this recording. But maybe for money purposes, he didn't want to bring in another drummer to do it, because hiring session musicians is not exactly cheap, I'm sure. And maybe his friend Tony Fernandez was kind of tied up at the time. Now, one of the saving graces of this song is when he starts playing piano. Now, I've said this in the past before, when Rick Wakeman goes on the piano, I'm a happy person. Because as far as I'm concerned, that is his best instrument. I've said it before 100 times. You guys are probably saying, yes, we've heard this from you 100 times already. But I have to reiterate it here. This song, as far as I'm concerned, would have been a complete snoozer, in my opinion, if not for the piano playing. Because the piano playing, I think, completely saves it on here. Another thing I'm starting to find a little bit difficult to notice is, what is Adam playing? Because if I'm to believe that he's on each of these songs, which I'm starting to get the feeling he's not, and from some of my research, I read that he's only on 2 songs, well, 2 songs written, and a couple of other songs he contributes a solo here and there. I'll get to that in a minute. But it's very clear to me that he doesn't seem to be on a lot of these songs, because unless he plays exactly like his father, then, you know, I don't think he's on this track, for example. Now, we're going to skip ahead to a couple of songs to track 6, which is Jigga Jig. Now, this is one of the songs, I believe, that Adam plays on piano. Now, this is a double piano piece, I believe. At least it sounds like it to me. Now, the thing that stood out right away on this song, and I'm going to invite you guys to confirm this with me, but doesn't that opening phrase sound exactly like "The Roof is Leaking" from Phil Collins' debut solo record? That piano bit sounds exactly like it. But then he's really good friends with Phil Collins, so I don't think he would have said anything. And quite frankly, I don't think that this song was going to be skyrocketing up the charts anytime soon. Well, not at least back then, for sure. But again, piano playing at its finest. I believe I read somewhere saying that this is almost like chopsticks for 2 people, which I wouldn't give me so harsh criticism on it as that. But, you know, it's Rick Wakeman behind the piano. I mean, even if he did chopsticks, I don't think that I would dislike it. I love his piano playing. Yeah, but this song at least does one thing for sure. It does show that Adam has very good chops, almost as good as his father on the piano for sure. They trade off of each other really nicely on this song. And even though it has a terrible title, I think that it's probably one of the stronger songs on the record as far as showing what they can do as a duet. And now we get to the part of the record which really made me put my hand to the forehead and almost really slap myself into unconsciousness. After the Adam, track 8, and number 9, possibly the worst title on this album, the Suicide Shuffle. After the Adam is an interesting song. It starts off very dramatically, and then as it continues on, it drops into this sort of instrumental piece where it has this rather cookie-cutter drum part that's programmed in. But what I start to notice about this song is that it starts heading into this territory that reminds me of music from video games. It really sounds like, you know, The Legends of Zelda Part 4. Definitely. It reminds me like I'm playing on the, you know, Nintendo Game Boy or something. And especially on the Suicide Shuffle, it sounds like something out of Super Mario Brothers. I kid you not, it sounds something exactly like out of Super Mario Brothers. I don't know if this was supposed to be some kind of inside joke between him and his son, but it very much sounds like video game music to me. With that said, it's even hard for me to kind of say whether I like the performance on it or not. I mean, again, it's never a question with me about whether his playing is good. The question is if he's actually putting an effort into these songs themselves. The more I kind of think about this, the man has a lot of records out. I think over 100, if I'm not mistaken, or at least close to it. But if you're approaching records like this, very slapdash, then yeah, I think that I could probably come up with 90 albums in, you know, 20 years if I just, you know, wake up one morning, put together the first 9 songs that come to my head and record them. I think that when Rick sits down and really puts his mind to it, those are the records that I really, really enjoy. All the classics from the beginning, and even now, The Red Planet, unbelievable. That is the way an instrumental record should be made, not like this. This is really, it's almost comical in some spots. And when speaking of video games and stuff like that, I'm going to shuttle back to a song earlier in the album. Track 3, Megalomania. this song, when it gets to about 50 seconds into it, reminds me of the theme music from one of these sports programs. I'm telling you, as soon as I heard it kick in around 50 seconds there, the first thing that entered my head was, this is CBC Sports. Today, we're going to be going to alpine skiing and downhill skiing later on. Like, it definitely sounds like that kind of music that I hear in the background when these kind of sports programs come on, or, you know, the Olympics, downhill skiing coming up later, or, you know what I mean? Like, it's that music that he's playing there reminds me of that sort of stuff. And, you know, he's done that kind of stuff before on White Rock when he was doing the music for the Olympics and stuff like that. So for that, I can understand. Was this maybe a holdover from one of those sessions? Who knows? What megalomania has anything to do with this music? I don't know. But again, it seems like this album has different sort of themes in there. Video game music, television themes. It's very interesting in that sense. Now, track 10, Past and Present, is probably one of the songs that I kind of really enjoyed on here. More great piano work. At first, I thought it was just going to be another one of these, you know, noodling on the piano by himself songs. But then we get to the Hammond organ and it kicks into a more straight ahead actual instrumental song with, you know, programmed drums and so on and so forth. And it's actually pretty good. It's well played. The Hammond organ stuff is good. Another one of Rick's strengths is his Hammond organ playing, I have to say. And the lead playing is much better on this song. It doesn't have as annoying a tone for the lead playing. And it goes in between these sections very nicely. Piano to Hammond organ, back to piano. Really, really well done. If the whole album would have been kind of more thought out like that, I think it would have been much, much stronger. Okay, and then we get to the last track on this record. Track 11. Painted Black. Yes, that Painted Black, the Rolling Stones song. What can I say about this? And trying to keep a straight face in saying it. It starts off with one of these dramatic keyboard sounds. Boo, you know, like, oh, something really exciting is going to happen now. And here it comes, the very 1980s Miami Vice-ish sort of drum part with keyboard bass. Don't, 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 don't. Don't. I was like, oh no, please no. And then I had to start laughing when I heard the accompanying, you know, those sounds that you hear during these times where they have like that steel pipe hitting together, a sound. Yeah, it's on here. Don't, 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 don't. I was like, oh no, please no. But oh yes, that is the rhythm that we have throughout this song. Nothing like the original one, of course. And a very sort of distorted sort of lead line doing that. And really, he already lost me right there. I mean, I'm not the biggest Rolling Stones fan in the world, which is probably helpful in this situation, because I'm sure a real diehard fan would have probably just, his head would have exploded listening to this song. Again, it's not a bad performance, but it just sounds tacky and cheesy. It just sounds like it was also done in the wrong era. I see here it says, you know, released 1993, but it can't be. It sounds like it's something from 1985. Yeah, so basically this record ends on a rather bad note. I think it would have been better for him to have ditched this and have just ended with Past and Present, the song that was before, which had the very nice piano and Hammond organ parts in it. So overall impressions, not favorable, which is disappointing because I love Rick Wakeman, as you know. I'm still going to be a huge follower of his and still going to collect all of his records, or as many of them as I can, especially on vinyl. But it's albums like this where I get disappointed with the guy, to be quite honest, because I know he has much better in him. I've heard much better from him. And even recently, with the Red Planet, I have been reinvigorated with his musical playing and writing again, because that's a fantastic record. I highly recommend that you check it out if you haven't. But this album, I would skip it. Honestly, it's nothing good. It just sounds like a bunch of leftover songs, or just songs that were written in 10 minutes. And then he asked Adam to come on in and, you know, play a little bit with him on it. So that's that. That's my thoughts. And I'll leave it at that. So let's go over to Kevin and talk about this further.
Wakeman with Wakeman. And I'm with Mark now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How you doing?
I'm okay. How about you?
I'm doing fairly well, thank you.
Excellent. Okay, so we both felt sort of overall pretty much the same about this album, I think. And I've just got the CD in front of me. I know yours hasn't arrived yet, but even down to the way it's presented, the sleeve notes and And bizarrely, I had a look on Discogs, and there's a British version of this, and there's also another version of this. And all they've done, they haven't really improved the production quality of the CD and the booklet, etc. They've just used a slightly different font, I think, is the only thing they've done to it. So I don't know, it's all sounds a bit flimsy, but let's get down to the nitty-gritty of it. And both of us thought that this was rather like 1983 rather than 1993. And that was down to the choice of some patches, as they say, the voices on the keyboards, but also down to the electronic instruments, the drums and the other bits and pieces. But what I was thinking was, I don't know what's happened here, because if you listen to something like ABWH, which was 1989, I mean, that was 3 years, 4 years before this, and that sounds really modern, actually. Not 1983 at all. I think that sounds pretty bang up to date for the time it was, and in fact, some really interesting modern-sounding keyboards, and it sounded like it was on the cusp of the 90s rather than looking backwards to the 80s. So why did Wakeman suddenly take a step backwards, do you think?
Money. I honestly think that this is one of these things where, he was releasing like 4 and 5 albums a year at this point. It was insane how many records he was putting out in a year's period. And I think a lot of it was just, like I said in my little segment there, I think that, you know, he had these labels coming at him and saying, here's $4,000, can you make us a CD? And he's like, okay, I'll see what I can whip up this afternoon. Like, yeah. It really seems like he didn't put any thought into some of these songs at all. And I think that, you know, when he goes in and gets somebody to just program drums, you know, getting a guy to program drums costs considerably less than hiring an actual session drummer to come in and record. Because you need to get studio time, and you need his own personal fee to drum, and so on and so forth, right? And then, you know, like, it's all these other things. Bass player you need in there, right? And the bass player then requires his fee, his studio time. When you can just program it on your keyboard, you know, it's cheaper, it's quicker. And, you know, you have the record done in a quarter of the time. Mm. But it also sounds like you spent a quarter of the time on it.
Yes, indeed. As you say, it does sound very much like he was trying to solve his financial troubles with quantity rather than quality. But if you listen to some of the... I mean, he's an amazing person, isn't he? If you listen to some of the soloing, particularly on this record, and if you imagine it with real musicians, as you've just been saying, then I think we would have a very different attitude towards a lot of the music here. And, you know, if nothing else, and if you can kind of ignore the backing, it's still some wonderful moments of Rick Wakeman Moog solos, Hammond solos, organ, and also Adam as well, bringing some things in there. There are some really great moments if you could extract all the annoying stuff.
Oh yeah. Like, I mean, that's without any question. Like I said before, it's never been a question about his abilities, his talent, his performances are always, you know, top shelf. I always said that. I mean, come on, I'm one of his biggest supporters, I think, as far as his music goes. But, you know, I mean, it's just some of this CD is probably one of those rare CDs. And I was trying really hard to think back if there was another one I can compare it to, but I can't at the moment think of one that made me feel like this is almost bordering on comedy. Like, seriously, like that Megalomania song. Yeah. Like, I'm telling you, when it got to that 50 second part, it literally sounded like, "Welcome to the wide world of sports." Like, it literally sounded like that to me.
Yeah.
And then there was so many moments of like video game music, like, you know, like, I'm telling you, that Suicide Shuffle is totally Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's totally that, you know, and it's just some of these things just, I don't know if he was, I mean, did he not want it to sound serious? Like that whole jig-a-jig thing. I mean, piano wise, it was very well done between him and Adam. Like, the performance of it is very well done, but I mean, the title just sounds ludicrous, and it's, you know, like, it just seems like he was putting a little bit too much comedy into it. Like, it's hard to take seriously.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, and it was interesting, the Adam connection there and what Adam actually added to it. And if you read the sleeve notes, which I realize you don't have those yet, but between reading between the lines of those, he's only actually on Paint It Black a little bit, Past and Present and Megalomaniac. In fact, I don't know if there's any Rick on there, because those are both Adam Wakeman compositions, interestingly, and a bit on that Suicide Shuffle that we'll come back to in a moment. So I think the only real proper collaboration might be the one called Jigga Jig, which is the two pianos. But I think he did, Rick Wakeman isn't hiding this, but I think he certainly added his parts over the top of Rick once Rick had already finished that. But I do like it. I think they complement each other really rather well. And I was thinking about whether that they did do shows together. And in fact, there's a photograph on Discogs of Rick and Adam on stage, each with a guitar. And that reminded me of your comment that this music on this album was tacky and cheesy. And the two of them standing at the front of it, you know, Rick with his cape on and Adam not with a cape on, but at least with a different kind of guitar. Again, it does look a little bit cheesy, to be honest, but I think a lot of this music with a real band actually would have come over a lot better as a live album rather than this recorded one. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think I've read somewhere in my research of this album, somebody made a comment on another page somewhere that these songs actually do sound considerably better in a live environment, especially on that live bootleg that you were talking about that's available of them. I don't even know if it's a bootleg. I think it might actually be an official
kind of
release,
official bootleg, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. But apparently that those songs come over much better. Apparently Tony Fernandez is on drums and another gentleman is on bass who plays, then they played much better. It's much more solid. And I mean, that was my point that I was trying to say before. Is if he would have just, you know, maybe flipped these guys a few, you know, $100 here and there and just get somebody to come in and do drums and bass, it would have added so much more to the songs as far as, you know, listenability. Because, I mean, a lot of these sounds are so dated, like that drum and bass and Painted Black was just absolutely ridiculous. Like, and that really bad, you know, hitting of the steel pipes together sound is just, come on, like how much more tackier can you get than that?
Absolutely right. And on that live bootleg, there are certainly one or two. I think it's only about three of these pieces actually played live by Wakeman and Wakeman, and it's difficult to find information about that. So if you listening did go and see Wakeman with Wakeman, I'm sure it was great fun, because they didn't just restrict themselves to this album. Of course, they went back into Rick Wakeman's back catalogue and played some of his fantastic stuff. And the other point I was going to make was that this was 1993. Now, of course, the internet wasn't back then what it is now, and I wonder if, as you say, it would have been possible making this album to do the same as he did with The Red Planet, even in lockdown, and, you know, give his instructions to Lee Pomeroy, etc., and they record separately and it's all stitched together. I'm assuming that is now actually a really affordable way of creating a new album, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because really all you're going to be really needing to do is just, you know, work out some sort of fee with the person, or if you're lucky, maybe he'll just say, okay, you know what, I'll play on yours on the condition that you don't play on mine the next time I do a record, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Right? So you can cut, you know, the fees down considerably doing that. But yeah, I mean, most musicians that I know have a relatively decent studio. It's certainly decent enough to make, you know, 48-bit, you know, or 24-bit, sorry, 48K. People can even do it better than that. But I mean, everybody has that availability now. So if that was an option, I think that would have even worked even better too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just a shame it wasn't an option at the time. And the other thing we need to point out, of course, is that this is 1993. That's only 1 year away from 1994 when Talk came out. And if you consider the use of technology on that album, it's like chalk and cheese, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's putting it mildly. I mean, the sound quality and the sonic fidelity of talk compared to this, it's not even comparable in my eyes. I mean, it's such a fantastically recorded album. I mean, sure, you can say whatever you want about the songs, if you like them or if you don't like them, but as far as how it sounded, it's just incredible how good it was.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, presumably they were even working on this music at the same time, Wakeman with Wakeman and Talk. And it's, yeah, they're very different beasts altogether. They certainly are. But you know, going back to what we've said previously, last week, that Wakeman, had he managed to stay in Yes and work with Trevor Rabin, who was the technological genius behind that album, then, you know, maybe Wakeman wouldn't have had to do this kind of album at all.
You know, I almost wonder if maybe Trevor heard this beforehand and said, maybe we should get Tony Kaye back. You know, it was almost so, you know, ridiculous, this record, that maybe it completely turned off Trevor Rabin of getting him back into the band. I mean, of course, that's being kind of comical on my end, but still, I mean, if that was even a factor in there, I wouldn't be the slightest bit surprised.
Yeah,
if that was his reaction, because I mean, my reaction to it, and like I said, you know how I am with Rick.
Yeah,
I'm a big collector. I collect everything. I love the man. You know, but this album was very disappointing. And let me just say one other thing quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
The one thing that I think is important to note about Rick is that when he has a focus and a direction, then he's a totally different person in a studio than he is when he doesn't have it. Because this same year, he had that album come out as well that he did, where it was inspired by the Island of Man or something like that.
Yeah.
With that other record that he did.
Yes.
And, you see, when he has a focus like that, where he can sit there and say, okay, all these songs are going to be based around this island, his records are much stronger when he has a focus like that. When he has something like this, where he has no direction at all, and it's just slapdash kind of put together thing, they're always terrible, these kinds of records.
Yes, it's really bizarre, isn't it? And perhaps that's why you do get these things like Suicide Shuffle with, as you said, the Super Mario Brothers Game Boy sounds in there. And because, you know, if there is no direction, you may as well just chuck that thing in there. Not a good idea, I didn't think. Okay, so many, many reasons to love Rick Wakeman's music. This, not necessarily one of them, but if you've heard it, and as I said before, particularly if you saw Wakeman with Wakeman, then do let us know in the show notes for this week. But let's just, as they say, draw a discreet veil over Wakeman with Wakeman, the album, and move on to something else next time. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
Whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.
Just before we go, here's the patron update. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Griselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. And half the Yes Music Podcast patrons are Mark James Lang, Martin Gelberg, Michael O'Connor, Miguel Falcao, Neil Caffrey, Paul Hales, Paul Tomei, Paul Wilson, Lobate Scarp, Rachel Hadaway, Mark Zarkol-Bags, Robert Naser, Scott Colombo, Scott Smith, Simon Barrow, Stephen Lamb, Steve Dill, Steve Perry, Steve Rode, Steve Scott, Stephen Raw, Terence Sadler, Tim Stannard, Todd Dudley, Tony Handley, Joseph Cottrell, Keith Hoisington, William Hayes, and new this week, Alan Begg. So thank you very much indeed to those patrons, including, before I forget, Robert and David. And welcome indeed to Alan. Thank you very much indeed. If you'd like to join those patrons in helping financially to keep the lights on here at YMP Towers, then please do just go to the website, yesmusicpodcast.com, and click on the link to Patreon. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much once again for listening. We hope to be back next week with some more Yes goodness. In the meantime, do please keep following the show on Instagram, on Twitter, or on Facebook. And until next time, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.